Hello and welcome to What a Scream, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Egrain, chats about horror films with a special guest. And we chat about a particular subject that I've previously randomly chosen and two films that fit within that subject. So this week, the topic is creepy kids. And my special guest is Michael Snoonian. And together we are chatting about two films that have really creepy kids in them. So the first one is Home from 2008, which I think is now on Shudder, if you would like to check it out, as well as Pet Sematary from 1989, which I think is getting a prequel this year, if I remember correctly. So yes, enjoy our chat about one of horror's most, in my opinion, terrifying tropes. It is creepy kids. So I would like to welcome to What a Scream, Michael Snoonian. How are you?
I'm doing great, Egrain. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Good, good. So can you introduce yourself to listeners and let them know what you do and who you are?
Sure. So within the horror community, I'm probably best known for two podcasts I co-host, The Pod and The Pendulum, which is celebrating its fourth birthday as we record this. So that's just exciting. And the just recently ended Psychoanalysis, a horror therapy podcast, which Jen Ferratu and Laura Unnersall and myself ran for about 3 years before deciding now is a good time to kind of like take a break from it.
Good, good, good. So how did you get into horror and what was the first horror film you ever saw?
So my grandmother used to pay her grandchildren. She loved horror movies, but was a big scaredy cat. Mm-hmm. And we would sleep over there all the time. And she would pay us $5 to, which in 1980, when I'm 5 years old, that's a gold mine right there. That is a lot of candy cigarettes and Bazooka Joe and button candy for $5. She would pay us to stay up late with her and watch things like Nosferatu and the old Universal monster movies. And I had an uncle who got us all into movies. He had the first VCR of any of us. And once a week I would go there. He would watch us after school while our parents worked. And he would just rent whatever. So at like age 7, I'm watching The Shining and Halloween 3. Just because he just, can we curse in this show?
Yes, yes.
He just didn't give a fuck. He's like, I want to watch this. And you can either stay in the room or not. So those are probably two of the biggest influences in terms of falling in love with the genre.
That's really sweet. I love it. Like when people talk about a horror kind of being almost a tradition passed down mm-hmm. through generations, it's yeah. really nice. And can you remember what the first horror film that you ever saw was? Or perhaps the first one that made a big imprint on you?
The first thing that made a huge imprint on me was actually a record. It was an album. Sorry if I'm cheating here, but like one side was an interview with Frankenstein's monster and the other side was an interview with Dracula. And the interview with Dracula, if I remember correctly, ends with the person getting the interview, like eaten by Dracula. And it freaked me out so badly that my dad ended up throwing out the record because he's like, I'm just not going to have you listen to this. I have vague memories of watching, probably was Jaws actually, because that would be on television around like 79, 1980. Mm-hmm. And I was allowed to watch. So either Jaws or Jaws 2, mm-hmm. one of those would have been like the first like quote unquote horror movie that mm-hmm. I consider Jaws horror. So
yeah, interesting. So our subject for this episode is creepy kids. And both yourself and myself are parents, so that makes for an interesting discussion. But what do you think about the horror trope of creepy kids in horror films?
I love creepy children. I think that, number one, I'm definitely at an age where it's like, you kids get off my lawn, and I don't understand youth culture as much. And I work around middle schoolers all day long. So in some ways, like children and young adults are just inherently scary. because I spend so much time around them, and I'm scared of them because of what they're capable of sometimes, and I'm scared for them because of what their lack of knowledge and their lack of insight can sometimes lead them to do. But there are so many great, starting with like The Bad Seed and carrying all the way over to movies like Cooties, like written and I think directed by Lee Wanall. There's just so, and The Children, like the great British horror movie, The Children, Who Could Kill a Child? It's like, how do you not love those movies? I mean, how, you know, unless it's like Children of the Corn 7, then it's like, okay, yeah, we don't love all things equally. Just like our children, we don't love all our children equally. I kid.
Yeah, there's something inherently scary about like a child that doesn't quite seem normal, I guess. And, you know, it kind of plays on these fears for non-parents who are like, you know, I've chosen not to have a child, or I don't have a child yet. And they're kind of looking at this little person being like, ooh, maybe this is putting me off even more. But then it also plays into like parental fears of like, okay, I've given birth to this little person, but we cannot control how they, we can to a certain degree, but ultimately you cannot control what kind of person they're going to be. And it's that fear of like, is my child going to be a serial killer, despite, you know, any sort of parenting I'd done. So that's what I get. Obviously, my reaction to creepy kids is a lot different now than it was like 10 years ago when I didn't have a child. So yeah, I find almost creepy kid films more scarier now as a parent. Like, it's the thought of being like waking up and your kid's at the end of your bed with like a knife held over you.
I have a memory of my daughter at 3. I was driving her to my mother's house, and I just said to her, like, oh, you know, like, Ada, we love you so much. And I will never forget what she said. She's like, one day you and mom will both be dead, and that will help make room for more people in the world. And I'm like, that is terrifying. Let's go visit Nana. And then I have to go like sit in a bathtub and just shake, because it was, yeah, the things are capable of saying. I have a question. What scares you more now? Would you say it's creepy children or children in danger in a movie?
I think it's creepy children. And it's funny because like loads of parents who are also horror fans who I've talked to have been like, oh, since I've had a child, I find it really difficult to watch like child violence. And for me, I haven't had that. In fact, I've gone the opposite way. Not that I'm enjoying child violence, but like I find I can go to more extremes now with my movie viewing, and I do. So yeah, it does. That doesn't affect me. It's creepy kids. And I think it's because, like, so I come from a background of quite a difficult childhood. And so I've made a conscious effort to be like, you know what, I'm going to try break this cycle of trauma, and I'm kind of, you know, do the best I can for my son while working on myself. And, you know, I'm going to respect him as a person, despite he's little, and just try and work on like breaking these cyclical traumas of parenthood, which then goes into your childhood. And my fear is that even though I'm working on this and I'm doing everything I can for my child, what if he still turns out to be a bad person? And I think I just have such a fear of this, that it's, whether it's a control thing, you know, it's just, yeah, it's a real deep-seated fear of mine that, like, you know, Ted Bundy kind of had an okay childhood, you know, he, despite, you know, a little bit of a family secret, it wasn't like a bad childhood, but like, he's one of the worst serial killers the world has ever seen. And you're just like, how do you process that as a parent?
It's hard. It is. Because we hear the phrase like, oh, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And then there's the assumption that if a child breaks bad, then it obviously has something to do with the parents. And in the line of work I'm in, you know, counseling and therapy, that is very often the case, but not always. Like, there's also like really hardworking parents and parents that like just try their best, but no matter what, like they're child or their kids don't turn out for whatever reason, the way that, you know, their upbringing would suggest.
What about yourself? What is your biggest fear? Is it the creepy child or the child violence?
I love child violence. it doesn't bother me, and often it's like I really liked Evil Dead Rise.
Me too.
But I thought it was going to end at the moment where the little one was going to get it, like a few minutes before the movie actually ends. Sorry for the spoiler. And I'm like, oh, what a ballsy ending. Like, oh, please. And it didn't end there. And it was still a fun ending. But my God, like the cynicism that would have been involved. I definitely, it is the creepy kids. It's kids that break bad. And again, like, just like you said, like as a parent, you know, we always want to do, like, we have one daughter, we have our only daughter, our only child, and we're very fortunate. Like, she's an amazing kid. I worry as a parent, like you mentioned, like cyclical trauma and like childhood traumas caused by our parents. Like, I had a mostly good relationship with my dad, but that 5 to 10% that wasn't is still really triggering. And I don't want that 5 to 10% to come out in my own parenting. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I hear it in my voice and I have to like really pull back in the moment so that it doesn't, I get angry, but more at myself. And then it's hard to, 'cause I don't want to, like you said, we don't want to do, yeah. So I'd say like my fears boil down to more me as a parent, like, am I doing a good job? Which I think mostly, and I'm very lucky to have a wife that's an amazing parent as well, that can like, hey, maybe you should like look at this a little differently. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. And we have an amazing kid. But yeah, I'll say it here. Like sometimes I'll hear a garage door open and it sends me back to being a very scared 8-year-old kid because dad was home and I knew I had fucked up something that day.
Yeah.
Which is maybe why I've never bought a house with a garage, despite New England winters. Who knows?
Yeah.
But we're not here to psychoanalyze.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because like my trigger is people stomping up the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
Like if someone's heavy footed on the stairs, it triggers me really badly. So I was like, oh, you know, here comes trouble, basically. Mm-hmm. It's the whole like another thing with like creepy kids, and I guess what that trope is playing off is as well, like when you become a parent, you have this idealized version of parenthood that you're like, my child's gonna be perfectly healthy and, you know, perfectly normal. And then you go through something like, you know, your child is neurodivergent, or, you know, they have medical needs, and it's just, obviously, they're not creepy kids because they're neurodivergent or have medical needs, but it's still that same fear of, is my child going to fit within society? And even though we shouldn't be teaching our children to be like, the epitome of living is to fit within society, it's still that fear of like, I don't want my child's life to be as hard as mine was back in the day. So, you know, it's the fear of the unknown is what it boils down to, basically. Mm-hmm.
I would say that, and I would say with where both of us have kids that were raised during this pandemic, and they lost a solid at least 1 year, if not like 2 years of socialization. And I know that, like, you know, my own daughter struggles with anxiety at times, and just when it seemed like she had it licked, the pandemic sets in, and then she's like isolated from her friends for like eight, nine months to a year. And that just set everything back in terms of like how to socialize with other kids. So we had to like revisit that all again. And your heart breaks for your kid. But at the same time, I know as a parent, the worst thing you can try to do sometimes is fix it. You don't want to see your kid in any pain. And you don't want them to struggle, but sometimes like they have to learn to struggle and overcome struggle, and they don't want to be fixed. They want to be heard. Sometimes it's so hard. It's like so hard to not just like, well, just do blah, 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 blah. But you're like, no, I have to pull back a little bit so they can kind of learn on their own.
Which I guess kind of leads us nicely on to the first film. So would you like to introduce your choice of film and give us a brief synopsis, please?
Yeah, for the first movie, we picked a 2008 found footage movie from IFC Midnight Studios called Home Movie.
Hi, welcome to the Jack and Emily Show. I'm Jack.
I'm Emily.
Let's have some fun.
I love the zoom on this. Make a smiley face. Come on, Jack!
Rocks at me.
What? Playing dead?
Dear Blessed Lord, thank you for the gift that you have provided for us.
Yesterday morning, Jack and Emily crucified the family cat. Oh. Jack and Emily cornered a boy and began to bite him, and they just wouldn't stop.
Let's have a staring contest. I dare you to stare until our movie's done. I bet you you can't.
What are you doing? Stop it!
It is about a family which consists of a pastor and a wife who's a psychologist, so a clinical psychologist. And they have just moved out of New York City to like very... maybe rural Connecticut. They're in kind of like a nice upper class, upper suburban setting, raising their twin children that are about 10 years old. And their twin children are showing signs of conduct disorder. They're basically psychopathic children that don't have any empathy, that don't know how to express any emotions, that are like really... cold. I forgot that they speak in the movie when I rewatched it. I thought they were selectively mute as well. And the parents try many things, both from like a Lutheran religious perspective and a pharmacological and psychological ways to try to like quote unquote fix their kids. And because it's a found footage movie and these things never end well, it ends horrifically for both parents in a really good sequence at the end. The kids are, you know, on par with like they would grow up to be the kids from The Strangers, I would say. Like you could almost say this is a prequel to The Strangers in some ways.
Yeah, definitely. It's almost a home invasion film from within the home.
Yeah. So it's coming from inside the house.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a massive fan of found footage. I think they're really effective. And I love that this film is like an hour and 15 minutes. Like it's short. It gets straight to the point. It's effective. It doesn't, you know, dawdle on and on and on. One thing that, so we open on this, I think it's Halloween it opens on, and the parents are really like, really into Halloween, and they're quite hyperactive as parents, and they're like blah 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 in your face. And it's really interesting to see the reflection of that against their children. Like, you know, we've got a male and a female, mother and father, and then we've got a male and a female twins, and it's reflected. It's almost like they're polar opposites. The twins are just like stony face, no emotion, like what the hell are you doing? And their dad is like in their face with a camera, which sets up the found footage the found footage aspect. But yeah, it was just like the parents kind of annoyed me a little bit, because I was like, they are just so in their face all the time, like, you know, coming from a child who, you know, I have a child who's autistic, and someone like, I'm neurodivergent as well, and I was just like, yeah, I'd be that way too if my parents were like that. So what did you think of the setup of the family dynamic?
And I hadn't rewatched this movie probably in a good 7 or 8 years, if not longer. And it's not a particularly well-known movie, but it just was the first thing that jumped into mind when you said like to pick a title. And I think it was because of the dichotomy between like the religious dad and the psychologist mom. And what I noticed this time around was like Adrian Pasdar, who plays the father, is so in the face of the kids. Mm-hmm. Not as much the mom. The mom tends to be the one to be like, let's pull it back a little bit. Let's mm-hmm. rein it in. The dad in particular seems obsessed with portraying this really happy nuclear family. Everything is good. There are so many dad jokes that you kind of almost wonder if the kids at some point were quote unquote normal, happy kids. And they just got pushed too far by dad just being obsessed with everything being perfect and making everything jokey joke. It is such a, it's the term that comes to mind is flop sweat, that the dad for any performer that like has ever gone out and bombed on stage. This idea that like, I am so obsessed with showing like this perfect family, I am going to will it into existence despite all evidence to the contrary. That's what really stood out this time around, was how desperate the dad was in particular to have things be perfect.
It really reminded me of, and obviously this was pre, I guess, vlogging was a thing, but this really reminds me of, like, my kid would watch stuff like Ryan's World and, you know, all those kind of rich kids being spoiled and their parents wanting to be the star of the show. Mm-hmm. And it really reminded me of that, when like these parents are basically exploiting their children for views and for money and sponsorships. And it just, yeah, it really struck a note with that, and kind of relating it back to that, and how, like you said, he's kind of trying to force his children to be a certain way and to come across a certain way when the kids aren't, but they don't have much of a choice in how they're presented in this form of media, which again I related back to these kind of viral parents and their children. The most disturbing thing for me was definitely their violence against another child in their class. That was the most disturbing aspect for me anyway. I don't know about you.
It's one of them. I would say the most disturbing thing for me was like the violence against animals. They have like, they, and this movie, like you mentioned Halloween at the outset, the structure of the movie is like every major holiday throughout the year, we're watching like a home movie, hence the, I guess the title home movie. But at Christmas, they crucify the cat. And I think the reason they crucify the cat is, again, just dad being annoying during like opening up the present. So they're like, we'll show you, we'll murder the family pet. That's what really got to me. Because I see kids act violent towards each other every day, not in this way, but like kids roughhouse, like kids roughhouse and don't know how to play. Although I guess I've never watched two children tie another one to a table, throw a garbage bag over them and threaten to eat them. So I guess, yes, that is, that's pretty disturbing.
Just a little bit. A
little bit.
So what did you think about this whole like faith versus science? So like you said, the dad is a pastor and he even goes as far as, even though there is no exorcist rite in Lutheran faith, he goes so far as attempting to perform some form of exorcism, whereas his wife is like a child psychologist and she's trying to go down the pharmacological kind of trying to figure out what's going on with them. So what did you think about that dichotomy between these two?
I found like the dynamic between David and Claire really fascinating this time around, because they seem, and I think at one point, like they videotaped themselves explaining how they got together, how, and how like they're very like, she's an atheist that believes in science and he's very much a man of God. Neither of them want the other, like they almost attempted, and so Claire doesn't, like she's pretty upfront about, I am going to like treat my children like they're my patients right now. And then he like does the exorcism in secret, he's doing all these rituals in secret, and neither, it almost feels like the other, each one doesn't want the other to succeed. Like they're not on the same page. Like as the movie goes on, at one point like she actually attempts to leave him because she thinks that like he's abusing the children, which he isn't. I found Claire fascinating because A, like everything she was saying about like conduct disorder in terms of like the signs of it and how it can blossom into blossom. That's a poor choice of a word, how it can turn into antisocial personality disorder when adult age is reached. It was spot on. And that's something you don't often see in horror. Like you see like trauma or mental illness exploited in a way that just feels often when it's like very explicit, it's done in a pretty inaccurate way. This was like really clear. What I found fascinating was like, I'm going to be the one to treat my children. And you know, my wife is a psychologist. I am a master's, I have a licensed therapist. And we've both said to our daughter, like, look, well, your parents, not your therapist. Like, we're not going to treat you like one of our patients. And there are times when my daughter might struggle with something where I'm like, oh my God, what would I tell a patient right now?
Yeah.
But it's different. I found that fascinating because rather than like entrust their care to someone else, like she is prescribing the medication and dad is reverting to just faith-based treatments, which I mean they're kind of like okay, I guess. I just found that dichotomy really fun to, I wish they did more of it actually, because they don't do enough. There is a really fun exploration to be had between faith and science or faith and psychology.
And it's, I mean, the exorcism scene is actually quite disturbing. I was quite like, ooh, by it. But then if you think about it, like Claire prescribing these medications to her own children is also very disturbing.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of, you know, you were talking before about like listening to your children, and it kind of that reflects back into it, that they should be taking a step back from being like, well, our children have to be perfect and how we want them to be, so I'm going to treat them myself the way I know how, rather than being like, okay, we're going to listen to our children, or we're going to find someone to listen to our children to figure out like what are their best needs, which is what you have to do as a parent. Like even when we're dealing with conflicts with our children, like, I mean, it's easier said than done, of course, but it's so important to step back at times and be like, okay, what do I have to my hand where I can step back and be like, right, what can I give my child, or who can I turn to that may be able to help me, rather than being like, well, this is how I'm going to deal with it because this is the only way I know how. So yeah, I really liked that kind of almost how not to parent.
Yes. And it's the Thanksgiving scene, I think, is the best example of that, because again, they're trying to have this Kodak moment, like, and then it's like, we're not going to eat until we pray.
Yeah.
I mean, who cares?
Yeah.
Right. If the kids are like sitting there quietly and they're not disturbing anything, they're not causing a ruckus, they just don't want to pray. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
But the dad so insists upon doing it. And they're like, you know what? Now we're going. Kids don't realize how much power they have, because if they just say no, like, I'm just not going to do what you say. Like, you can't. Okay. Like, what are you going to do? You're like, oh, shit, I guess. So, you know, we have a standoff. But they're like, no, now we're going to fuck up the whole dinner because you're so adamant about creating this moment.
Yeah, that moment was really funny, because like we have a thing where my son doesn't like to sit down and eat. He likes to move around a lot. And at first, because it's been so ingrained in me that we sit down at the dinner table and you eat your dinner and you do it quietly and nicely, at first I was like, sit down, I need you to sit down, sit down, it'd be this whole thing. And now I'm just like, you know what? I don't care. Like, you're eating. It doesn't matter. Like, why does it matter if he's sitting down and being like, it doesn't. And it's just, it's that kind of like, why is it so important they pray? Yeah. Like, why can they not just eat?
I used to get so angry if my daughter wouldn't eat the dinner, because I'm the cook in the house. Like, I cook probably like six nights a week. And I would get so mad if she wouldn't eat the dinner I made, because growing up, it was like, this is dinner. If you don't like it, you don't eat. And my daughter loves to cook. So after a while, I'm like, okay, you don't like what I made for whatever reason. Even though it's really good, I'm quite a great cook. But whatever. Now it's just like, you know what? Go fix yourself something. Make a sandwich. Yeah. Make yourself some eggs. Like, and I'll even, because it was such a conflict before, and it could get, you know, like I could get pretty cross. Now I'm just like, hey, this is what I made. If you don't like it, just go. I start dinner with like, if you don't, just so she feels at ease. If you don't like what I made, just feel free to make yourself something. Don't sweat it. Just don't throw it out. I'll save it for my lunch or something.
Yeah. It's the same in our house. Like, if you're not going to eat that, you can have cereal, you can have fruit, you can have a sandwich. Yeah, it's just important to realize that your kids are individuals and they're people. And like, if someone sat me down and tried to force me to eat something that I didn't want to eat, like that's really like traumatic. Like, you know, I don't want to be forced to eat something. So yeah, it's this realization that your kids are individuals, and that you can't force them to be a certain way or do something that you want them to do. So within this film, what, obviously there's this kind of point where they're like, is it a supernatural occurrence? Are they being, I can't remember what the entity is called or what they call it, but there's this ambiguity about whether it's supernatural or whether these are just little serial killers. What did you think about that?
I fall under, you know, I would say like when I first watched this movie, I would say I probably would have fallen under, oh, it is supernatural or it's 50-50, who knows? Now that like this is my field, I'm like, oh, it's very obviously conduct disorder. Like there's nothing, they're just like two kids that want to watch the world burn. So I'm falling under like it's the more psychological. How about yourself?
I mean, as a fan of like supernatural stuff, I would have, you know, been like, oh, cool, it's supernatural. But you know what? I think it's more scarier that it's it is like a personality disorder, and it is it's just that's the way the kids are. And I think that as a parent, that is so much, because you want something to blame it on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you realize that it's just them, you're like, oh no.
It's like, I think it's important. Like David and Claire aren't bad people.
Yeah.
Like they're not awful people. They're not even bad parents. They're really struggling. What did you make of the New Year's Eve scene when they're arguing about whether they should go back out into the city and see their old friends? I thought that was a really powerful scene. That's one that really stuck with me.
Yeah, I guess it kind of resonated with me, because when you have a child, and especially one that has perhaps different needs, there is those things where you're like, okay, I want to go out, and like I want us to all go out, but is it going to turn disastrous? Like, are we all going to be pissed at each other by the end of it? So I could relate to that scene a lot.
And I related to the dad, what the dad was saying, what David was saying was like, you're afraid that if we go out and see all the old friends from New York, so it kind of is hinted they've left New York because of their children and moved for a fresh start, the inevitable question is going to come up, how are the kids? And we are both terrified about how to answer that question. And I found that was like one of the really like that stood out to me, like that stood out as a part where like, oh, they're afraid, not only afraid of their children, but they're, like we were talking about earlier, afraid of how other people are going to perceive them. Will they be pitied because their kids aren't behaving? Will they be seen as bad parents or a cautionary tale to other prospective parents?
Yeah, definitely. So would you recommend Home Movie to horror fans?
I would give it, if you like found footage movies and you like creepy children movies and you like movies that are under 80 minutes, absolutely. It's not necessarily a super gory movie. I would say that there are more creepy and scary bits throughout the 80 minutes than typical found footage. It's hard to find. I think it's on Tubi right now, and you might be able to find it on sites like YouTube. So just saying, I would give this a big thumbs up if you're a fan of found footage and a fan of creepy kids. It works.
Yeah, I would as well. It was a completely new one to me. I'd never heard of it before. And I really enjoyed it because found footage is, you know, one of my things. And yeah, I liked the tension build up, because mm-hmm. even though there were moments where nothing was happening, I was still like, oh God, what's going to happen? Like, what's going to happen now?
Those last 15 minutes are traumatizing. Again, how close they come to getting away and then can't. Like, those last 10 to 15 minutes are really good.
Yeah. And it's especially that thing as well, where it's like, it's two kids. They're bigger than these kids. They're older. They should be smarter, in quotation marks. And it's like, how are these kids overpowering them? You know, it's just that, it's that fear that, like, you think you're in control as an adult, but you're not.
Yeah. And when you see the mechanisms they and how long they've been planning something like this as well, that's when it becomes like really disturbing.
Yeah.
The clubhouse reveal, when they go into the no parents allowed, like, basically it is like, I mean, I don't know a better way to describe it. It's like the whole scheme is laid out right there. It's just, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So let's move on to my choice of film then. So I went with 1989, the year I was born. Woo woo. 1989's Pet Sematary, directed by Mary Lambert.
What is this place?
I brought you here to bury Ellen's cat.
Daddy, is Church all right?
Why, Judd?
I had my reasons.
I dreamed he got hit by a car and you and Mr. Crandall buried him in the pet cemetery.
What did we do tonight, Judd?
What we did, Lois, was a secret.
May the Lord bless you and keep you.
Has anyone ever buried a person up there?
May the Lord make his face to shine upon you.
You're thinking thoughts best not thought of.
Daddy's gonna do something really bad.
You're thinking of putting him up there. Don't deny the thought hadn't crossed your mind.
Come back to me, Gage. Come back to us.
And written, the screenplay was written by Stephen King as well. So yes, it was adapted from Stephen King's novel, and it centers around the Creed family, who have just moved to this new house with their children, Ellie and Gage, and their pet cat, Church, of course. They meet their neighbor, who I think is hilarious because it's, you know, Herman Munster. They meet their neighbor, Judd, who's very nice, and he kind of tries to explain to them that the road that they live on is very dangerous because a lot of truckers go by very quickly. And he says, you know, watch out for your cat and watch out for your toddler. You know, let's be sensible. Do they listen? No, they basically stick their fingers in their ears. But yes, while Judd is showing them around, he shows them the pet cemetery where all the local kids' pets have been buried. And then one day, when Louis Creed, who is a college doctor, he goes into work and this poor guy has been hit by a truck and his brains are basically everywhere, and Louis stays with him and helps him. And this guy then becomes a ghost motif, which follows the family around. And while the kids and the wife have gone away to the wife's family, Pet Cat gets run over. And Judd shows Louis a part of the pet cemetery that goes up into Stephen King's favorite trope, the Indian burial ground. And he basically tells him, like, if you bury this cat, it will come back, but it won't be the same cat, but you should do it anyway. And Louis goes, oh, okay, then I'll do it anyway. Of course, the cat comes back, not quite the same cat. And then one day when they are flying a kite and being really irresponsible parents, Gage walks out into the road and unfortunately gets hit by a truck. And of course, Louis has the idea to bury him up at the Indian burial ground. Gage comes back as a homicidal toddler and fucks shit up, basically. What are you a fan of Pet Sematary?
I am. I grew up in the 80s, like, reading Stephen King at far too young an age. I think this was done at a time when, like, King's works weren't adapted that well. Like, everything after A Dead Zone by Cronenberg, you know, except for Stand By Me, but that's not really a horror movie. His horror work was, like, the adaptations are really bad. And this stands out as, I think, as good as you could have done at the time. And I think it benefits from King writing it. It's a, and it's especially like you said, Fred Gwynne as Judd is so wonderful. He's the perfect main accent. So yeah, I'm definitely a fan.
Yeah, I haven't seen this film since I was like 16. Mm-hmm. So I was at that point, I was reading Stephen King and then watching all the adaptations. So this was a revisit for me and it was definitely interesting. So when I first saw it when I was 16, I was like, oh, creepy kid. Like, and also side note, the little boy that plays Gage, Miko Hughes, is fantastic. Like for a 2-year-old, an amazing performance.
Mm-hmm. Same kid in A New Nightmare as well. That's Miko Hughes. He plays everyone. Yeah. So what a run for Miko Hughes.
But yeah, now going back and watching it as a parent, I'm like, these people are so irresponsible. They are such bad parents. Like, surely if the very first day you move into a place, your neighbor goes, like your kid goes to run out onto the road and your neighbor saves him and says, watch out. You build a fence and a gate.
Yes.
Like, that is your first role as a parent, mm-hmm. to be like, I need to baby-proof this place. And the fact that they don't, they're like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And then, like, turning their backs on their toddler as he runs after, they see mm-hmm. him running after a kite, laugh at him, turn their backs on him, and you're like, what is wrong with you people?
Yeah, they're the not... And I made a note as you were doing your synopsis. It's like city folk, you know, and it's a, you know, Stephen King is a rural Maine author who still, you know, spends most of his year time in Maine. City folk coming in thinking they knew better than the local folk. Like, sure, they give lip service to Judd, but they don't really listen to him.
It's just, it just blows my mind. I'm like, you see those massive trucks? Like, no. So, yes, they are a very interesting pair. One thing that popped out to me this watch was the relationship with death, that the mother, Rachel, is like, she's very anti talking about death because of something that happened with her past, which is also like really horrific. Probably one of the scariest moments in horror is her sister, Zelda. Ugh, nightmares. But yeah, they've all got like a really messed up relationship with death, and you know, they don't want to talk about it, and it's weird. It's almost like this amplification of the West's reaction to death, that it's feared rather than it's a natural part of life. What did you think about the talk of death?
So I will say this, like, I am definitely, I don't know if afraid is the right word, but fascinated, or I've started to do, as I hit my 40s, I started to do a thing like living my life in fractions, like what fraction of my life have I lived? And I'm at 48. I'm like, okay, I probably have more days behind me than ahead of me, even if I live into my 80s. So, and I don't, and I guess what pulls me out of this going, well, when I'm dead, I won't know that I'm dead. So it's not like I'll wake up in a tomb and be like, oh, yep, stuck here again today. So yeah, I could understand Rachel's fear of, especially given the parenting and the upbringing that she had, like that part, it really resonated with me. And then also, like, how do you talk to your kids about it? We haven't had any major, since my daughter's 12, like, knock on wood, no one that we're very close to has passed away since my daughter's been at an age where she would understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always been quite frank with my son about death. So, you know, he knows what cemeteries are. He knows that there's dead people buried there. When my granddad died, even though we weren't close with him, you know, my son was like, why are you upset? And I explained to him what death is and what it means. But like yourself, he's never experienced a death of someone close to him. So it's not like he has that logical processing where he can go, well, someone was there yesterday, but they're not there today. So he hasn't had that. So until we reach that point, you know, I can't really comment much on it. But what I understand is, if you're as age appropriately honest as possible with your children. That is the best way to be.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, you know, there's this moment in Pet Sematary where the little girl Ellie gets really upset about the thought of her cat Church dying, and Rachel goes to Louis, promise her that he'll never die, or it's something like that. And Louis gets really angry at her, her, because he's like, when it happens, then I'm the bad guy. And I like that is such, I think that's quite an important moment in this film about our relationship with death.
Yeah. It's again, it's two people that are not on the same page as one another when they're parenting. And, you know, you don't have to agree about everything as a parent. It's probably better that you don't agree about everything. But some of the big things you have to kind of get together on. And I would say that is really one of them. Because it feels like at times like Louis is parenting three children, including Rachel, because she has like such an underdeveloped and immature view on certain subjects. As a parent, you kind of have to have a handle on.
Yeah. So what did you think of the Zelda aspects of the film and how it kind of portrays like illness and terminally ill people as monstrous? I have my viewpoints on it. What is yours?
I mean, this is where, like, it's weird for me because, like, as someone that works in public health, I should be advocating against portrayals like this, because it does turn, and for listeners out there, give a listen to Nicole Goebel, her podcast, Bodies of Horror, where she talks about how disability is portrayed in horror. She's just brilliant at it, and it's someone you can learn a lot more from her than me in terms of how it's portrayed, because it is awful. But I go back to like the perception that we're seeing of Zelda is we're seeing that perception from a young Rachel who is like nine years old, and I'm not gonna fault an 8 or a 9 year old for having that perception. I fault more like her parents, Erwin and Dory, who locked Zelda up in a back room and ignored her and just wished the problem. They threw money at the problem. Like they were, and by what I mean by that is like they were out and about on the town and they were just leaving like hired help or their young daughter there to care for Zelda, their daughter. So from like a public health and from a advocating for like seeing like the dignity in all persons despite any disabilities they might have, it's awful, you know. And I think it's a real criticism of Stephen King is how he writes overweight people. He often writes fat as either something that's monstrous or as something that is used as comic relief. And you know, as an overweight guy, I again should be upset by that, but in terms of like as a storytelling device, or it's pure nightmare fuel how Zelda is used here, and it's one of the standout bits of the movie.
Yeah, I agree with you that like if it wasn't from a child's perspective, you know, this is something that a child wouldn't have a full understanding of, that they don't really grasp, especially if their parents are avoidant, they don't grasp what happens to the human body when it is ill or disabled in any way. And so yes, from her perspective it would be monstrous and scary, but when we look at it from an adult's perspective, we're like, ooh. And yeah, like as much as we, like Stephen King is adored, he is very problematic in some of his writing, especially when it comes to his, in quotation marks, Indian burial ground trope.
Yes.
Super problematic, and like, get over your obsession with this because like, ooh. Yeah. Yeah, and then obviously his fat phobia, which is transferred to his son as well. A lot of his Joe Hill's stuff is fat phobic as well. So yeah, it's interesting to kind of look at that criticism. Sorry, go on.
I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, go for it.
Do you read any modern King?
No.
Okay.
To be honest, no.
I feel like that is he, as a writer, has like tried to do better. He doesn't always get it right. As in, who does? Who always gets it right? It's in areas where maybe he's improved a bit, but I definitely think you could look at his classic works. I'm someone who has said like Stephen King was a much better writer when he was like shoving fistfuls of cocaine up his nose. I will say like, yes, but I do think that he's someone that tries to do better as he has aged, which usually as we age, we tend to get maybe a little bit more stuck in our ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to know then.
Yeah.
So what did you think of the character of Pascal and how he was portrayed? I think it's really, it's, it sounds terrible. It's almost comedic. But he's he's following Rachel from the airport and he's like influencing the air information desk worker. And it's just, oh, cringe. They could have left it out, really.
That shit is funny. that shit is, and I don't know how much of that is Mary Lambert's kind of being like a bit cheeky with it. I mean, number one, like the practical effects that are used there, the gore is incredible. Like the exposed skull, the brain, the flap coming down. It's super creepy, but that is offset not only by his delivery of Brad Greenquist's delivery of the lines, but he's in these like short shorts and like a little blue hoodie. He's kind of dressed like a little boy. Like he's almost looks like Dennis the Menace. And there's a cheekiness to him. And then like when he's like, well, what about like the Dodge? And then like the car, the rental car saleswoman, her whole demeanor changes and goes really robotic. And then she's like, oh, but it has a long scratch down the side. Like, who would give a fuck if a rental car, a scratch down the side when I'm in a hurry? Well, we can't have that. The shit is fun. And he looks so pleased. Like this shot on the air, in the airplane when he's there flying, he looks so pleased. I don't know. That cracks me up. It's really funny.
It is. So for me, the end sequence, the second end sequence with Gage is possibly my favorite bit of the whole film. Mm-hmm. Like this child is evil, and like there's a point where the most horrific injury I can think of, where he hides under Judd's bed with a scalpel and then slices his Achilles tendons, and I just, that is horrific.
Yeah,
and the noise it makes, like,
he is cutting into that thing, like he is cutting himself like a nice thick chunk of like Italian bread at Sunday dinner, and he's gonna like slather that thing with some butter. It is so awful.
Go ahead.
It's one of those things where like Gage still has the proportional strength of Gage, a 2-year-old boy. So it is kind of funny that Judd, this grown ass like Herman Munster, 7-foot-tall Sasquatch, doesn't do anything except sit there in mortal terror because, like, yeah, there's a 2-year-old who's just severed your leg veins. You're like, oh shit, this is not good.
And it's so funny because when Rachel comes upon him, I think it's Rachel or maybe it's Lou, and he's dressed like Willy Wonka. Like he's got a little cane and like the top hat. I'm like, what's going on? Like, why is he dressed like that?
He's just a fancy lad. Yeah, it's like a David Copperfield cosplay in the middle of this horror movie.
Yeah.
But you never see, like, you get this really, like, up-close violence to Judd. To the point where they not only slice his Achilles heel, but they slice his, they give him, like, the Joker smile.
Yes.
Gage bites a chunk out of his neck, but you never see the child attack the mother, because that would almost be a step too far to see the mother like just destroyed like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good shout. And then when Louis injects him, or Louis, I can't remember, is it Louis or Louis?
Louis,
whatever. He injects him to kill him. You know, it's quite a humane death. Me, I'd be there with a big cast iron pan smacking them in the face, whereas he's like, I'll do it the humane way, I'll put him to sleep. And it's so funny because Gage goes, not fair. He goes and like sits down.
and he topples over. Like when he falls, you just hear this, like his head like hits the wall. It's like thunk. So here's my question, because it's the Wendigo, from what I remember of the book, it's the Wendigo, and the Wendigo I don't think is even discussed in the movie. That like whatever is possessing whoever is buried, it is like the Wendigo.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, it's horrific. Like Gage psychologically torments Judd, and he tells mm-hmm. him like, your wife is like sucking cock in hell, and she knows that you visited whorehouses when mm-hmm. you got back from the war. She knows that, and now she's in hell getting passed around back to demons. It's really horrific mm-hmm. to think about. Do you think there is any bit of Gage inside of there, or is it pure demon using the human body as a vessel? Because not fair is just something a 2-year-old would say.
I don't know. Like, that's a really good question. Because obviously, I doubt a 2-year-old has the capability to, like, extend some psychological warfare mm-hmm. on people or go that hell for leather trying to kill them. It's interesting whether the demon kind of possessing him takes on this kind of childlike psychology, because it is a child and it only has mm-hmm. so much kind of potential. I don't know. That's a really good question. That's stumped me quite a bit. What do you think?
I don't know. I think that there's like a part of it that is still there, but mm-hmm. whatever you're buried with, like whatever gets into you when you're buried under mm-hmm. that ground is steering the bus.
Yeah.
Is definitely, it's kind of like vampires, like the demons in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like you retain all of your memories and who you are and were, but like you're no longer your human self.
Yeah.
But it's just like, it's creepy to think about, and it's creepy to think about you've had to kill your child for a second time.
Yeah. So the final sequence it's quite a nihilistic one. Mm-hmm. So Rachel is killed by Gage, and of course, having not learned his lesson, Lewis takes her body up to the burial ground and of course sits against the fridge playing solitaire until she comes back. What did you think about that, the ending?
It's right from the book. Except for the fact, I think like the only thing I don't like about the ending is like when it fades to black, you hear Lewis scream.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, you just get Rachel in a very gravelly voice saying, lover. And then the book ends, which I think is a far more,
mm-hmm.
it's even more nihilistic, because you know that it's going to be bad, and now you don't know what will happen next. I vacillate between feeling very sorry for Lewis.
Yeah.
Because I think he's a guy that is in over his head. Everything has been stripped from him. But at the same time, and he's just not equipped to deal with mm-hmm. what's going on. My heart breaks for Ellie during mm-hmm. that scene after the funeral, when she is like sobbing and Judd is like, you still have a daughter, you need to go to her. And he's just not able to do it.
Yeah.
And if you had this knowledge that there's this thing that could bring back the people you love, even if it changed them in awful ways, would you be tempted to do it? And would you be tempted to try to redeem them if it was possible to do it? So that's the thing. That's what I don't get. How about yourself? What do you think of this?
I mean, so the Mary Lambert had filmed it that pretty much like the book ending, where, you know, we see Rachel comes back and then it ends. Mm-hmm. So it leaves a real kind of like uncertainty about what's happened. But apparently the studios are like, no, we need it to be even darker. Mm-hmm. So that's why we got the ending we did. I would have preferred her original one, I think. Yeah. Just that level of like not knowing what happens when it fades to black, you know, kind of like death itself. We don't know what happens when mm-hmm. it fades to black. I think I would have preferred her original ending. But yeah, like you said, like I love films that put you in that position where you're like, okay, what would I do? Like, would I do that? Or would I be, you know, but it's one of those films where it's like a morality dilemma for the audience. And I like that. I like that about this film.
Why do you think Judd shows Lewis the cemetery? Like, why do you think he brings him there in the first place, knowing, like he says over and over, this is a bad place, it's sour, the ground is spoiled and sour? Knowing that, why does he bring this person, this stranger, this outsider there?
I don't know. That's one question that I can't quite wrap my head around. I'm like, why would you do that to this family?
Yeah.
Knowing full well that that's exactly what he's going to do, you know, dangling it in front of his face, basically. Yeah, that's a strange one for me, one that I can't quite answer. What are your thoughts on it?
The only thing I can come up with is when you have something that this, it's such secret knowledge, it's too tempting to not let someone know. Mm-hmm. It's too big of a secret to keep.
Mm. Yeah.
That's all I can come up with.
Yeah, maybe. And I guess if you didn't tell him, we wouldn't have a story, would we?
Yeah. It's like, so we need a movie. Yeah.
we need the plot to move along a bit.
Yes.
So I take it you'd recommend this to horror fans then.
Oh, I would recommend it. I definitely would recommend it. It's a classic. It's a classic late 80s horror movie. I would almost recommend Pet Sematary 2 more than this one.
Okay.
It's because it brings Mary Lambert's, she brings like a very punk, very kind of like sense of anarchy to that movie. Like Stephen King hates it. And it's a very much a like give no fucks, this one's for me type of movie. My only complaint about this movie is it is so beholden to the source material. Like there's like really no surprises if you've read the book. And I think the book, it's a lot deeper, especially as a parent. Like it is something where you feel, especially most of it's from Lewis's perspective. As a dad, you can definitely feel like where he's coming from as someone who's like gone from a young guy about town to like, now I'm responsible for these people and I don't know what to do.
Okay, I will definitely check that out then, because I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So out of the two films, which if someone was like, I have these two films, I want to watch a film about creepy kids, but I can only watch one, which one would you recommend over the other?
You know, I think I'm going Pet Sematary, because it's such a classic and it would fit like the Halloween season. I'm a big sucker for like how it uses Maine and New England. I have one gripe. If anyone has ever studied physics, there would not be enough of Gage to bury when he's hit by that 18-wheeler.
You're right.
It would be like you'd be pouring him into a can of beans, like an empty bean can.
Yeah, you're right. He
would not be so intact, but I do think that this would be the better movie of the two.
Yeah. For me, I'd ask whether that person is a parent or not first, because I think if they are, I'd go for a home movie. Just because I think it's a bit more kind of like freaky for parents. Whereas if they aren't, then I think I'd say Pet Sematary, just because it's a classic. And like, like it's one of those films that if you want to watch a spooky horror film, then pop it on. Like it's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think if a person was a parent, I'd be like, go watch Home Movie. Freak yourself out about your own kids. So yeah, that'd be mine. Do you think that they're in the horror movie cinema universe, do you think anything different can be done in modern times now with the trope of creepy kids?
I think there's a lot that can be, because kids interact with each other in such different ways now. A lot of their life is led virtually. My wife and I were talking the other day about like, do we feel like kids have the same general sense of like curiosity about the world around them? And we've come to the conclusion, because like they're less engaged in storytelling, like TV shows and movies, and more in like short bits, like TikTok, less so. So I think there's a lot that can be said using like technology in children. Mm-hmm. I also think that there are things you can do, how we try to manipulate kids with like wellness, and how we try to like manipulate families to having like the perfect type of family. You can adapt that to like what we're doing now, but I don't exactly know how I would do it. I mean, there's always going to be, every generation as we get older, we're going to be afraid of or for our children in different ways. So there are always going to be a way to tap into those fears.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same wavelength as you. But I think something to do with the internet, technology, the way it's gone, a good filmmaker could definitely play on those fears. Because I guess like that's another fear I have about children. It's like how rapidly technology is growing, and especially communications technology. It's really scary because I'm like, I'm seeing everything now and I'm like, what's going to be around when my son's 5 at the moment. I'm like, what's going to be around when he's a teenager? What fears am I going to have for him when he's that age? And it's just like, yeah, I think if someone tapped into that, that would make a really good, really good horror film.
Yeah. I'm not someone that believes cancel culture is a thing.
Same.
I do believe that it's funny, as we've become more accepting of like gender fluidity and being like gender constructs aren't necessarily a binary. Mm-hmm. I think that like forgiveness has become more binary, or how we see people, morality has become a lot more of a binary. Mm-hmm. Someone is either all good, or if they misstep, they're all bad. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's some interesting things that can be done there in terms of like how as younger generations like exacting some justice on some persons they feel don't fall in line with like their particularly worldview. There might be some interesting things that are done there.
Yeah, definitely that whole like council culture versus accountability culture. I think that would be a really interesting shout out. Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting about Creepy Kids. So before we go, I always ask my new guests, what is your favorite horror film?
I have to say it's an American Werewolf.
Okay.
London, my favorite. Mm-hmm. I think the best horror movie of all time is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. But God, like American Werewolf in London is just the perfect movie. It's probably why I married a British woman. the comedy just still hits all these years later. Mm-hmm. And every time I watch it, I find something new to absolutely adore and fawn of over that movie.
Yeah. It is a great film. It is. So where can people find you on social media?
Sure. So if you want to listen to our shows, you can hear The Pod and the Pendulum is still running. We do shows, if not every week, then at least like 3 episodes a month. Mm-hmm. We do all franchises. You can find thepodandthependulum.com, at Pod and Pendulum on Twitter, and just seek us out wherever you like, Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, yada, yada, yada. You can follow me at Mike_Snoonian on Twitter. Same on Instagram and on Letterboxd at Mike Chump Change.
So that was my chat there with Michael about Creepy Kids. And together we chatted about 2008's Home, as well as 1989's Pet Sematary, directed by Mary Lambert. So what did you think about this week's episode? Do you enjoy the trope of creepy kids? Do you have a creepy kid? Let me know on Twitter at @what_scream, as well as Instagram at @whatascream. And I'm also on Blue Sky now, preparing to jump ship, possibly, maybe. So yes, don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, wherever you're listening to us on, and stay horrific. Goodbye.